That'll take you 20 minutes or some to walk up the highway. He rubbed his chin and broke into a big smile. Say, would you like to use my car? I loved the idea, but after discussing my lack of US permit and insurance, we shelved it, and I resigned myself to the walk. I pocketed a couple of items from the hiker box on my lap that had been made by Trailblazer himself, the contents clearly bearing the hallmarks of a previous hiker. A couple of band-aids, a Q-tip, and some vitamin I. I thanked him, picked up my empty pack for the groceries, and stepped out into the bright morning. It was a trudge, and I berated myself, with a grin, about walking unnecessarily when I had so much bloody walking still to do. Ruminating over my night with Buckshot, I was slightly dreamy, when in the distance, on the quiet, misty road ahead, I saw a deer step out of the trees onto the hardtop. It was huge, even at this distance. What a massive deer, I thought, like a moron. How unusual. Then a truck came over the ridge of the hill and slowly cruised down towards me. The deer wasn't the slightest bit perturbed by the vehicle, but I certainly was, because even at a distance, this deer was much larger than the truck. What a weird thing. My perspective must be off. I squinted, shook my head, and refocused as though the view was one of those magic paintings you would squint at and eventually see shapes in the pattern. Then the penny dropped. Moose! It was a bloody moose! Wow! I broke into a hobbling run on my bruised feet, muttering an entreaty for the animal to stay right where it was until I could get there. It was so far away from me that I knew it was hopeless. The truck swooshed close past me, and my clothes flapped in the dirty breeze. I stopped and stood instead, enjoying the last moment of watching the majestic creature step delicately hoof over hoof across the road, turn its giant, serene head towards me once, and then gracefully slip into the woods on the other side. My mouth was open. Did I really see that? It was a giant. I hustled as fast as I could to the spot it had vanished into and peered into the dimness between the pines. Gone. Damn it. I resupplied at the mart with more than I needed, as ever, and bumped into the others coming in as I left. I hung by the door to wait for them, and we all piled back into the laundrette without seeing any more moose. There was something I didn't like about how Buckshot rifled through the hiker box and discarded it. I knew he liked to travel light, and there may have been nothing of any value in there for him. But I had seen Trailblazer look pleased when I picked up one of his little bundles, and I knew he had bought more of the things that were in there for people coming through. Perhaps I'm soft, but with Buckshot, it felt like watching a child ripping boxes open at Christmas and walking away to the next thing, disinterested. It was already clear to me how much wonder and joy on this trail came from the network of people surrounding it, so I could see that hikers needed to give gratitude as well as take gestures of kindness. Sam came and drove us all back to the hiker hut for our final night before we hit trail again, squeezed into his car amongst the bags of shopping that I already knew I wouldn't be able to fit into my pack. Every time I leave a place, I leave a bulging hiker box, but I kind of like that. I felt good right now. Great, even. There was a warm glow in my chest because I was with a little group that I liked. I was feeling more confident on the trails. I had rested a little, and now that I had some kind of attraction in the mix too, things felt even more exciting. There were more people at Sam's than when we had left. An entirely different set, which made me marvel that we're all having the most exciting and challenging time, and it feels like we're the centre of the universe. But half a day, or a day behind us, is another group of people for whom the same things are happening, and so on and so forth behind them. You could hike the whole trail and never meet the people a day behind you or a couple of days ahead. I was introduced to some of the folk who sat engaged in various tasks. Abby, an illustrator, was finishing a beautiful watercolour of a wooden plank bridge she'd crossed. She told me she was taking the trail slowly, because she wanted to stop and draw along the way. Bonsai was also there, goofing around and telling stories of how he was a coast guard in real life. I watched Buckshot's eyes roll at his stories of bravery and daring do, looking to tamp down any rival showboating like a dueling peacock. Fucking Coast Guard, that's the most stupid of all of them. Just sits in a little room watching the sea, never really goes anywhere. Huh, he ain't gonna make it. I ignored him and asked if anybody had nail clippers. My nails seemed to have grown more in the last 2 weeks than in the last 2 months, and they were cutting into my toes. Perhaps walking for 10 hours a day might be the cause. Jeannie brought some over, and I started clipping, gathering cuttings in my hand to throw away, which made my friends laugh at me. Jeannie didn't laugh, though. In her early 60s and from Alaska, she was a serious woman who always seemed very focused on whatever she was doing, and now she was looking at my can of beer next to me. Her gaze scanned the others and their beers. Buckshot was on his third or fourth. Her mouth pursed into a little line. I didn't like to feel judged, but the gang were getting louder and I didn't want to seem ill-mannered. So, semi-successfully, I engaged her in conversation about her hike so far, then returned the clippers. Oh, my poor feet. Bruised and battered already. Some blisters and blackening toes. I gingerly stepped over in the darkness to the cooler by the picnic table to get a Sprite, meeting a couple bent over, the woman immersing her feet in an ice bucket. I dipped to scoop a can out of the slush and asked how she was. She's okay, her partner answered. She looked at me, her expression so sad. I glimpsed her feet in the bucket, swollen like melons, with puffy ankles and calves. Oh no, what happened? I couldn't imagine it was a sprain, not on both legs. Leukotape. It was the leukotape, she said. Leukotape is the special zinc tape that hikers use to plaster up their feet on hot spots to prevent blisters. I didn't own any, but probably should. Her eyes welled up. I think I'm allergic to it. I've been here for 2 days now and the swelling isn't going down. I think I have to stop. Her partner put his arm around her as she started to cry, crushed disappointment on her face. To be out of this so soon, after planning so long. I could imagine how she felt, as it was my own fear writ large on another person. I nodded and murmured some support as Sam came by and swept me back towards the bunkhouse under his skinny arm. On the way, he gave me a hug and whispered in my ear. I have been watching you. I can see what's happening. I stopped. He stopped alongside me and grinned, eyes twinkling in the light of candles and solars. Sam was a nice guy. But what was this? What do you mean? I looked at him, smiling politely, but resigning myself to it being something annoyingly smutty. Buckshot. Those guys. They're great fun, Gale, and you're having a ball. But they're not going to be good for you. I can see how you look at him, and I've been looking out for hikers for enough years to have seen all sorts come through here. They'll keep you partying and whooping it up, but they can carry on, and you'll run out of steam, and then it'll go sour. Have some fun, but be careful. He's a taker, not a giver, and for all the excitement he brings, he's only going to think of himself. I wasn't sure how to respond, because after our days in the Rangeley Motel, I could only agree on some sensible level. But I was going back into the forest, and that's when this crew became my teachers. I needed them. And, besides, I liked them. The night grew quieter, with only Bonsai still singing to himself and drinking by the fire. The rest of us hunkered down in the bunkhouse. Buck in the bunk above mine, kissing me before bed, holding my hand over the wooden rail and saying, "Is this what you mean by affection?" Then grinning down at me in the gap between the bunk and the wall before he rolled back and slept. I stayed awake for a while, considering how I was going to manage to blend my real-life self and my wildlife self. Being sensible and making good, responsible decisions seemed to fit only in the past. Wasn't I out here to achieve something different? I had the urge to be reckless, do questionable things with wild and free people. Sam was right, but I wasn't for turning. I'd managed to stumble upon some wild ones, and I was sticking with them. We started out as a group the next day and strung out into a line as was becoming the norm. I kept my eyes peeled for beaver in the lakes and swamps on either side of me and enjoyed fireflies in my tent at night. A couple of days later, I had my first experience of trail magic proper as I ascended a climb set back over a deserted highway. There, in the dirt, sat a white cooler with AT Hikers written on the lid in Sharpie. I flipped it up, and inside sat all manner of treats. Sodas, freshly made sandwiches labelled with marker PB&J or Nutella, snack bars, chips, and a spiral-bound notebook sealed up inside a Ziploc. I wrestled it open and read. We, Jerry and Simon, love to provide magic for the hikers who come through here. Please take whatever you need, but leave some for those behind. We also love to know where you come from. Please write your name and hometown in the book. I flicked back, reading names from all over, a mix of trail names and real ones, with the locations mostly in the USA, but some further afield, like the Israeli man I'd met on some boulder or other, face all smashed up from falling over, full of stitches, but only a week or so left before he had to join up in the Israeli army, so he wasn't stopping for anything. I grabbed some crackers and stuffed them in my mouth, delighted to sit and stop. Just then, Smudge came up from behind me, fit, young, sweet, and everything you'd want in a trail buddy. We chatted, and then behind him came Jerry and Simon themselves, excited to be replenishing the cooler while there were actual hikers eating from it, like fishermen checking their nets, but only to feed us and see us go free. They told us they'd seen an otter and a bald eagle on the short drive from their house, and I then listened to other gathering hikers tell tales of all the beaver and moose they'd seen too. I was clearly making too much noise stomping up and down to see the wildlife. Trail magic was the perfect flytrap for north and south hikers alike, and we stopped to chat as a tiny bubble for 10 minutes before I filled in the logbooks for our magic couple and then started out. Always keen to get a little ahead, because I always expected to be overtaken. I didn't know where we were going to stop that night, and I didn't really want to camp alone yet. I wasn't ready for it, so I needed to be far enough ahead to keep up when I was overtaken, but not so far ahead to be a far outpost when everyone else stopped for the night. It was Lazy Bean's birthday, and the four of us had started out that morning together. Buckshot pulled away ahead, and while I waited for my favourite couple a few times, it was clear they wanted to take the day slowly, smoking plenty of weed and enjoying the views. That was fine. I'd catch Buckshot, and they'd catch us later. Lunch was spent on a warm, sunny log with another panoramic view, lazily munching peanut M&Ms and making peanut butter tortillas. I moseyed on, happy to be with my thoughts and stopping to pick pine needles out of my socks every 20 minutes. Oh, for some gators. Hours later, and still no Buckshot. It wasn't until balmy late afternoon that I found him sitting at a viewpoint. I had begun to feel anxious that I was caught in the middle, Buckshot thinking I was back with the others, and they believing I was up ahead with Buckshot, neither needing to give me much thought. So I was very glad to find him. There you are! I was wondering where y'all had gotten to. It wasn't that Buckshot was a super fast hiker. He was just tall and had enormous endurance. He could hike for 15 hours a day without feeling any ill effects. A steady pace and consistency was all he seemed to need. No, they're miles behind, I said to him. Well, I don't think they're coming if it's his birthday and they're not here already. Probably just smoking bowls and making love in the great outdoors. He grinned and gestured around at the beauty. And you, Appalachian Gale, how are you doing? We talked about my worry of being between people, of getting lost in the cracks and of not feeling safe. He listened carefully and asked why. I tried to explain, but I didn't quite have the right words. The story of my being attacked in the past wasn't fluid enough to articulate, and the highlights of it, or lowlights if you like, seemed trite to blurt out like a staccato headline. So instead, I burst into tears. From nowhere, really. I just said I had been assaulted before, and that being out here in the woods with no one knowing where I was or how to get to me, and in a foreign land, had me all kinds of anxious. Right. Well, let's get you a gun. A fine response, but not the one I needed. Very kind, Buckshot, but not necessary. I can teach you to shoot it, or maybe pepper spray. Y'all want that? I'll get you some of those. I nodded, wiping tears from my face and deeply grateful that he wasn't minimizing my fears or making me feel weak or broken. You'll be okay. You can do this. You stick with me. I'll hike with you for a good while yet. It's another month or so until I need to go off and pick up my speed. I can hang back with you, and I'll keep you safe. He didn't try to hug or kiss me, but leaned over to touch my leg. We like you. You're with us. We won't let anything happen to you. And with that holding of space for me to be afraid and accepted, I felt my heart expand and my connection to him deepen. Think you can do a few more miles as it grows dark? It's a hell of a descent, but I know a place by a river. Sure. I nodded and followed him on wobbly legs for another 6 miles to a place of beauty and solitude. We made love under the pines and stars, cooked a hearty meal in the darkness, and cowboy camped by a roaring river, miles from anyone. New Hampshire, 160.9 miles. Chapter 9. These mountains have serious range. Maine released us into New Hampshire, a state filled with beauty, high mountains, and fancy tourists. Buckshot and I piled into Gorham to take a zero before tackling the famed Presidential Range in the White Mountains. We hit town within hours of each other, him before me, and I called to see where he was before I went to the hotel I'd booked for us. No reply. Strange. I settled in and showered off the filth, hanging out all my clothes and sleep gear to try to dry it after having been pelted by rainstorms for the past 24 hours. I tried him again. Nothing. Perhaps he'd hit a bar or was with trail friends somewhere in this small town. He often knew people along the way from his previous hikes, so I wasn't going to worry too much. However, when I finally got hold of him, he didn't sound quite right and had, mysteriously, booked himself his own cheap motel room up the road. "But we'd arranged to stay here," I exclaimed. "I don't understand. Are you okay?" I couldn't quite place his tone, in a mood I wasn't familiar with. "Yeah, well, I forgot." He was hostile for some reason. "I got so wet, I needed somewhere to be and dry out. Didn't know how long you were going to take." He tailed off into a mumble, and I told him where I was and to come on over when he was ready. A few hours later, there was a knock at the door. I'd had a bath and was lying on one of the two double beds in a daze, staring at the ceiling and breathing in and out with the throbbing of my feet, knowing I was ravenous, but not sure where to go for the biggest feed or if I had the energy to get there. I opened up and let him in, the smell of spirits wafting in before he followed behind. Drunk. Drunk by mid-afternoon and in a strange mood. I wondered what was going on, sat back down and gave him space to roam the room. "What's wrong?" I asked after a while. He'd opened a beer from the fridge that I'd stocked up for him and was tapping his foot, looking into space. He glanced up. "Nothing, just tired." Lies, I was sure. He was a man who clearly enjoyed his own space, and I wasn't surprised that he'd wanted his own room. But I was surprised that after our intense time together in the last weeks that he couldn't tell me what was troubling him. Eventually, he put the beer down and came over, pulled me off the bed and into an embrace. It felt off. "No, wait, Buckshot, this doesn't feel right," I said, pushing him back. He stopped and stood looking at me. "Can't we just, you know, hit the bed and not worry about it?" he asked, averting my eyes. "Well, no, not really. Something feels strange, and I need to know what it is. If you can't tell me, then okay, but jumping right into bed feels like I'm being used as a distraction more than anything. So, no. He looked annoyed and sat down again. Instead of his beer, he pulled a half-empty quart bottle of vodka from his pocket and swigged from it, nearly draining it completely. He lifted his head again after a moment and said, "Can't do this anymore." My heart dropped. What did he mean? The friendship? The sex? The clearly emerging relationship we were in? "What?" I asked, keeping it simple so as not to give him any ideas for any extra things he couldn't do. He stood up again and put his back to the wall, between the thin plywood door with the feeble chain and the small circular side table, covered in rows of noon hydration tablets that I'd ordered in bulk for everyone to have. There was a hollow knock as the almost empty bottle of vodka hit the wall through his coat pocket. He pulled it out, slightly frowned at the contents, then polished it off. "I can't do this, Gail. It wasn't my plan. None of this was. I had set myself a goal, a target, to do this damn trail in 100 days. I was going to start with Lazy Bean and Dozer and then just go ahead when I needed to. My folks need me back home to cut trees before winter, and I can't." He hung his head, breaking the earnest eye contact he'd just held. I wasn't new to this, these conversations of people saying they can't and then giving reasons why. Sometimes it would be me, and sometimes them. But either way, I could kind of tell when the words or the gestures were genuine or not. It was clear to me that although his reasons might not be the full picture, he was absolutely a torn man. He was sad, and I could see it. "I understand, Buck," I said. "I know what you wanted to achieve, and I'm so glad we had this time together, but it makes me sad that you have to be unkind about how you're telling me. I don't understand why we can't do this nicely. What are you so irritated and upset about?" "I just can't have a girlfriend on trail, Gail. I can't." He stared at me, then away, frustrated. I was surprised at this. I hadn't thought that he had considered it that way, or was even beginning to. I certainly had wondered how we might go about shaping our lovely connection, considering his pace and mine didn't truly match, which wasn't going to be sustainable. But I didn't realise he'd been stewing. His moods had ebbed and flowed over the past weeks, that was true. Sometimes he would make me go off before him in the morning, saying he wanted time to smoke and that I should get miles under my belt because he'd catch up so quickly. But then, when he'd catch me a couple of hours later, he would be a different man, offish and cold, seemingly cross with me for reasons I couldn't fathom. If I asked him about it or probed at all, it would make everything worse, so eventually I stopped asking and waited for the dark clouds to pass. I just figured he was mercurial. Now it appeared there was more. "I get it, don't worry. We have something lovely, you and me. We don't need to worry about it. I'm sad, though, that you want it to end like this. Really sad." I could feel myself starting to rip a little inside. The reality that this might be it was just hitting me. He could just go. Out of the door, back to his hotel, and then hike out the next day or that night, and I could feasibly never see or hear from him again. We were in an unreal world, and I was in a foreign land, and he had become the linchpin to my experience, my root system, feeding me friendship and security up through the soil of our connection. What the fuck was I going to do? But also, damn it, I was hopelessly attracted to him. How had this happened? He wasn't my type. He chewed tobacco, tucked dip in his lip, carried bags of weed in his pack to sell to hikers, didn't brush his teeth that regularly, and was pretty single-minded and obtuse. But my gosh, it somehow worked. Pheromones, is that the thing? The thing where he didn't smell bad or look bad to me. That made me overlook all the signs that we might not be suited in real life. The thing that made my head swim when I was close to him, that made us unable to stay away from each other. I didn't know, but I did know that I was watching it disappear from me, across the room, and I wasn't sure I believed or understood entirely why. "I didn't mean to get attached to you," he said mournfully. "I was just hiking, man. And then there you were. And now I just want to hike with you. And it's fucked everything up. I can't talk about it. I don't want to. I just gotta go. I don't want to leave you. And if I could carry on hiking this whole damn trail with you to the very end, I would. But I can't. So I've got to make myself not care about you anymore. I'm leaving, and that's it." He put the empty vodka bottle down on the table as I felt a wash of deep sadness sweep up and over me. "Okay," I said. "I don't want you to go, but I understand. You don't have to be so hostile, though, Buckshot. I don't understand why it all has to be so sudden." But he had turned already and was partway out the door. Without a further goodbye, he was gone, slamming the door behind him. I cried all night under the flickering TV playing a biopic of JFK Jr. I was there, working on Cape Cod during the summer his plane crashed into the sea. Day after day, people came to search the shorelines for him. Lost. Pulled under. It was sad, and it fitted my mood. Eventually I slept, letting go of the wondering what was next. In the morning, I decided that all there was to do was carry on as usual, and so I met up with a very special father and son duo. Diesel, Dad, slow and steady pulling up hills, and Pony Express, tall, fast and light-footed, who had hit town at the same time as me. It was a zero day, so after a full breakfast, I wandered the strip of road that formed the town, diving into pawn shops and wishing I had a suitcase to take home treasures, looking at guns and knives of the like I've never seen in real life before. I meandered to the post office to mail some postcards, and on the way back, dulled and tired, I heard Buckshot yell my name. How? He was gone. But he wasn't. "Hey," he said when he got closer, pack on his back and pole in hand. "Wondered if I could come chat to you for a minute." "Sure," I said, completely unsure of what to expect. Did he just want to get some noon tabs? Some beer from the fridge I'd bought him the night before in preparation for a good time? He loved to take things I offered, and sometimes things I didn't. Tucked into the fusty dimness of the motel bedroom, with the sunlight winking through the pulled curtains, he explained that he'd tried to leave town, but couldn't do it. He didn't want to leave me. His realization, he said, was that he'd rather be with me and not finish the trail in 100 days than not be with me and be miserable. "I'm sorry," he said, earnestly and clearly. "My behavior last night, it wasn't okay. I don't know how to talk about my feelings. All that stuff. You know, I just..." He tailed off and looked at the floor. "I get it," I said, so relieved and shocked at this expression of his care for me. "There are things you don't understand, Gail. Things I can't talk about or explain. But I don't want to talk anymore. Can we just carry on? Can it be like last night didn't happen? Please?" "Sure," I said, not knowing quite how I wasn't going to probe deeper about the things I wasn't allowed to know about. I mean, that was now all the stuff I wanted to know. But I was wise enough to realise that for right now, it was best left to settle. We spent the rest of the zero day as usual. A little resupply, a little drinking and sex, some laundry and TV. Then, later that day, Lazy Bean and Dozer rolled into town and called us. We welcomed them into the room, and I offered the second double bed. The day stretched on. Buckshot's father had flown into the area on business and arrived to take him to a bigger town for a few hours to get some new pieces of gear and hang out. When he returned, he brought with him a pair of trail shoes he'd found that were in my size on sale. He knew mine were falling apart and proffered them to me as a gift. I was again surprised, but happy. Very happy. More laundry, chatting and beers followed, and then bed, but not before packing to leave. The next morning, Buckshot and I rose long before dawn, leaving the Steinbecks for their zero and rest as we headed together up into the intimidating whites. I wasn't to see Lazy Bean and Dozer again. The White Mountains are a slice of the Appalachians. They are high and hard, containing the highest elevations of the northeastern USA. Our first port of call was the Presidential Range, and we went for it, traversing across more mounts than I could remember to count. Perhaps 11? Madison, Adams, Jefferson. It became a blur of huge boulders and elevation that took your breath away. It was steep, difficult, and felt endless, despite taking just over a day. I would have done less if I had been alone, would have stopped in one of the overpriced and exclusive huts on the way to beg a bed, but with Buckshot's encouragement, I kept going, hiking well into the dusk on the descent out of the range, my legs shaking like Bambi and my aching feet making me wince with each step. It had been a dangerous day. Mount Washington has some of the worst weather in the USA, and if bad weather is predicted, then the advice, starkly painted on signs at many access trailheads, is to abandon all pride and plans, back down immediately, and return another day. Luckily for us, we had clear weather, but people often die up there. I didn't die, but I did fall very badly. It might have been my worst fall yet. Head down and marching forward over uneven rocks, the wind buffeting me and blinding me with my hair. I was walking, and then I was falling. Forwards, at speed. Wrestling with the straps that attached my poles to my wrists, I got tangled. I couldn't get my arms out in front of me to protect myself from falling face forwards onto the moonscape rocks that were rushing up to meet me. Resignation to incoming pain hit me before the ground did. Then a jagged edge met my chest hard. I was winded, squirming face down, pain racing through my front like a defibrillator must feel like. But still, in that briefest of moments, I was glad my chest had broken my fall. There'd been only centimetres to go before my face would have met the next rock down, and then things would have been much worse. I couldn't get up, though. My heavy pack pinned me to the ground, and Buckshot had already hiked far ahead. But then, mid-wondering what would happen to me, I felt a hand on my back, and my pack was lifted up from behind, taking me up with it. Once on my feet, I turned to thank my saviour and took her in with a gasp. She was a girl in her 20s, with blood under her nose, a cut on her eye, and black swelling on one side of her face. "You okay?" she asked me. Me? She was clearly hurting. Yes, just. I couldn't seem to take a full breath to be able to speak. I was clearly not quite okay yet, and was also beginning to feel embarrassed, which she could see. "Don't worry," she said. "It's easy to do." I couldn't stop looking at her face. "What happened to you?" I asked bluntly. She looked blankly at me, as though she wasn't quite in there. "I fell over earlier today, just the same as you. Only, when I did it, it was so shocking and painful that I wet myself." She paused and watched my eyes widen. "Did you?" Dumbstruck, I shook my head, staring at her and imagining how much it must hurt, knowing, like her, that there's no way down this mountain range that's easy, and you just have to get through whatever happens. Observe, detach, and keep moving. "Well," she said, "you're doing okay then. Have a good hike, and take care." And with that, she walked past me and steadily away, as I touched my body to reorient myself and check for injury. My rib, oh, my rib. It hurt to breathe in, to breathe out, and to buckle my front chest strap. It also hurt to swing my arm with my pole. Oh well, I knew that if it was bruised or cracked, there was nothing to be done but keep going. So on I went, stunned by the hardship of this range and simultaneously annoyed and glad that Buckshot hadn't been here to see me go down. But mostly, I was thinking about the girl with the smashed face, who had stopped to help me while deep in her own misery. Kindness was riven through this dirt ribbon. On the way down that night, I experienced my second cowboy camp with Buckshot. The Appalachian Mountain Club managed the huts in the Whites, and they charged a lot of money for people to stay in packed rooms of small bunks. If you arrived late, but not too late, but also not too early, then the crew of young folks who were working in each hut might let you help them out with the washing up or cleaning that night, then let you sleep on the dining room floor once the paying guests had gone to bed. I didn't mind the idea, but Buckshot wasn't having any of it, preferring to spend the night out under the stars in the cold elevation than give in to the rule of the AMC and clean their dishes. We would, however, be heading to one of the final huts the next morning on our way out of the Presidentials, purely because there was often cold leftover breakfasts being given away for free on account of the crews not wanting to carry out any more waste than they needed to. But that would have to wait until morning. As the sun set that night, Buckshot pushed through bushes and undergrowth to a secret spot he remembered from a previous year, where trail crews stashed their tools. We picked over axes and rebar to spread out our mats in the dirt. He didn't even cook or eat, too exhausted to bother. I set about heating up stove-top stuffing mix with half a stick of butter, and then lay back, full. Glad that I'd carried on. Glad Buckshot had agreed to sleep across the entranceway to the small clearing so wolves would get him instead of me. The only wolves were in my imagination, and blissfully happy to be under huge dark skies and eschewing a tent to count stars and feel the wind on my face. The next morning, happily uneaten by wolves or bears, I decided I liked cowboy camping. Buckshot woke in a good mood, and after I'd brewed coffee, urged me to hike ahead to get whatever cold pancakes and sausage might be waiting for us at the hut on the way down. He was happy to sit and smoke, taking some time to pack up camp slowly, he said. Pack up camp? He had the least possessions of anyone I knew out here. Off I went, though, on to coffee and to fill my tummy at Mitzpah Hut. Then it was the long, difficult descent down Mount Webster Cliffs to the road at the bottom. Legs like jelly from the previous day's exertion, I stumbled and fell often, tired and feeling a little flat. Buckshot had passed me after breakfast, as expected, but his mood was now sullen and dark, as though something had occurred in the time between my leaving him and his arriving to join me. Like I had made him mad, but I hadn't been there to have done so. I couldn't worry too much about it, as survival was my focus. It wasn't beyond me to trip over my own 2 feet, and on the crumbling shale ridge edges I'd pay for it with more than simple embarrassment. On the other side of the fast highway at the bottom, Buckshot was waiting, visibly angry. He'd broken his new pole. There was no cell phone service to call his dad, who had some of his gear, to resupply, and it was beginning to rain. His dad had also taken some of my non-essentials for the last few days in order to lighten my load a little, and that included a heap of my meds. I felt panicked, thinking I wouldn't get them immediately, but knew when not to speak to Buckshot, so I sat silently by the road while a plan formed in his head. "I'm going up the road to try to get service," he muttered, and disappeared up a small hardtop road leading off the main highway. He wasn't gone too long before he came bounding back down with a huge grin on his face. "You get 2 guesses," he shouted. "Cell service? Nope. A store? Nope. Trail magic. A whole damn setup with tables and chairs and a tarp for the rain. Woohoo! Come on, let's go." We hustled up to the top of the road, which was part of the AT connecting back into the next set of White Mountains, including Franconia Ridge. There, in the parking lot, was the spread as Buckshot had described. Everything an exhausted hiker could wish for, from hand sanitizer refills and toilet paper bundles, to chips, cookies, and a whole barbecue grill set up for hot dogs and onions. Our kind host was a man called Whispers, who enjoyed setting up in different places on trail to pay back the magic he himself had received as a hiker some years before. A slight man, in his early 40s, with long dark hair cascading around his shoulders, he smoked a traditional pipe and talked of his other loves in the real world, such as the tech field he worked in. We filled up, and he exhorted us to take more for our packs for later. Then we whiled away a good few hours, resting and chatting, with northbound hikers coming from the other direction to join us, staying to swap stories of what was ahead for each of us. In the latter part of our time there, I heard whispers and Buckshot speaking in hushed tones, and picked up that our host was a fervent lover of New Hampshire and all the off-the-AT trails that meant you saw more, felt wilder, and didn't have to stick to the formulaic path that was white-blazed. Purists didn't get to experience these, they agreed. I joined them as Whispers described a wild and remote route that looped through the Pemigewasset wilderness along the next stretch. Taking this off-trail route meant that we wouldn't go up and over the ridgelines with the storms that were coming. Whispers described the things we'd see en route. Old logging camps from the late 1800s, washed-out bridges and deserted settlements left to the elements. Buckshot's eyes lit up, and I knew we were headed for an adventure in the following days as he accepted the paper map with instructions and sketches that Whispers proffered to him. We didn't make it far that night into the trail before we pulled over and slept out in a hollow next to the path on a bed of leaves and bark. It was a terrible place to sleep. Mosquitoes and bugs trampled our skin all night, but we were exhausted. I was now taking more of my meds than ever to stave off the agony in my chest from my fall, slightly worrying that they were never going to last me the length of the trail, and that I'd need to find a way to replenish them, or risk seeing what life was like in withdrawal and without them. After 14 years of a steady low opiate dosage, I had a fairly good idea that running out wouldn't be pleasant, and that ibuprofen and paracetamol were not going to cut it. The next day, we followed the AT until we came close to a rushing river swollen with snowmelt and took a moment to orient ourselves. The AT continued on and up into the storms that were brewing overhead and already peppering us with rain. The paper map showed that if we crossed this river, then we would begin the Pemi Wilderness Loop, which would eventually deliver us back onto the AT, just before the ascent onto Franconia. Buckshot looked at me, clearly giving me a choice. He was going to explore, and I was welcome to go with him, but if I wanted to stick to the tried and true AT, to not deviate from the white blazes, then I was welcome to go and perhaps see him down trail. Phone service was sketchy and rare here. After listening to the two men talk the night before about the benefits of stepping off trail to see different routes and sights, I was sorely tempted. I didn't like to do what I was supposed to do. Even if I was the one that had decided I was supposed to do it, for example, hike the AT. And so, with a wash of cold fear in my tummy, I let go of my attachment to the blazes and the marked safe trail I had been following, nodded at Buckshot, and stepped onto the wide, flat river rocks marking the top of a waterfall, moving onto the wild, less travelled road behind him. He was gone in an instant, and I quick-stepped after his pack that was already disappearing into the thick green undergrowth. This marked the start of 2 days of off-route wandering that changed how I looked at the maps and altered my adherence to the fixed trail from then on. We forded wide rivers where century-old bridges had been lost and were now mere lumps and bumps midstream. We scrambled over downed railway tracks, explored abandoned tools and cauldrons left from 100 years before, and joined flat, overgrown tram routes that led us where we needed to go. Silence under the canopy. No waiting for other AT hikers to come up from behind, or passing northbounders from ahead. I was still tired from the presidentials, so we camped a night in a scouting campground we found after making it to a more well-trodden route, and then rejoined the AT at the base of Franconia Ridge the next day. I was very glad for the experience, and happy to have missed the socked-in storms and wild rain atop the last set of ridgelines that AT hikers I met were talking about. Non-purist hiking definitely had its benefits. Franconia Ridge was long and hot once the rains had gone and the sun came out. I had run out of water, not realizing the distance under sun that I would need to traverse before I hit the next source, so I was glad to see day hikers coming up the side trails to enjoy the views in the summit. It took a little asking, but eventually one group gave me some of their spare water, eyeing my bleeding legs, scratched arms, and filthy face with no small consternation. "Hell, miss, you can't even breathe properly. What happened to you? You need me to call someone?" "No, that's okay," I replied. "I just busted a rib falling on Mount Washington a few days ago. I'm a through hiker." And I smiled at them reassuringly, which I'm sure looked deranged and manic. Perhaps the very reason they gave me their water was because I looked like saying no might not be an option. Delirious with heat and thirst, I came skidding down from Franconia Ridge on a side trail, clinging on and swinging off of branches like a kid to hasten my descent. Arriving in the car park, I could see in desperation there was no easy way into town. No buses or shuttles. Buckshot was long gone, and I couldn't give a shit where at this point. He'd be somewhere around, but I was focusing on the fact that I was going to have to attempt my first yogi ride. I began a tentative approach to a group of folks who were clearly walking towards some cars. But just then, a nice girl named Katie, whom I'd met on the ridge, came over to ask if I was okay and offered me a lift. Thank goodness. I was delighted to accept and learned all about her passions for the outdoors and her study of forestry at Purdue as she chatted merrily to me on the ride. She dropped me along the road in the usual strip-style town I was getting used to seeing, and I made my way to a Dunkin' for a cup of tea. Of course it would be tea when I was feeling out of sorts, soothing and familiar. Smelly and tired, I got chatting with a lovely couple at the next table who were visiting the area. During the back and forth, Buckshot messaged to tell me he was at the fabled Chet's and I should come. I looked at my maps. From where I was sitting, Chet's was about a 45-minute walk through some suburbs. Why do American towns need to be so long? I just couldn't face it. Maybe I'd just live here in Duncan now. My legs were not going to move. My lovely new Dunkin' friends asked me what was wrong, and as soon as I explained, they offered me a lift and dropped me at Chet's door, stinking to high heaven, I'm sure. People along this trail continually make me want to be a better person. Chet's place was the stuff of lore, and I'd have found it hard to find without Buckshot's help. Chet himself had been an avid outdoorsman, who suffered catastrophically when his stove exploded whilst camping a number of years ago. He was left with life-altering injuries, blind and confined to a wheelchair, but this hadn't dampened his passion for hiking and hikers. Living right in the middle of the beautiful New Hampshire mountains, he had taken the money awarded him in his court case against the manufacturer and poured it into providing a place for hikers to stay, rest, eat, and recover in the garage and carport next to his home. People paid if they could, or helped out with chores if they couldn't, but most did a little of both. His garage was filled with bunks and armchairs, and the basement was a kitchen wonderland filled with boxes and packets for hikers to take. I was grateful and happy to be there, especially as it wasn't an advertised or official spot. We ended up staying at Chet's for the night and decided on a zero the next day, which would mean a second night. I loved the feeling of a night before a zero. There was no need to go to sleep early, no need to gather your energies. You could sit and talk until late, drinking and having fun, which is exactly what we did. I walked back to town and picked up some IPA for Chet and cider for us, and we sat on his veranda putting the world to rights. Little did I know that my world was going to take a shake back into wrong the very next day. The zero started lazy. There was no one else in the bunkhouse that night, and in my single bunk I wasn't stirred awake by Buckshot snoring. We'd resupplied, wandered around doing our own thing in the morning, and then reconvened back at Chet's around midday, lolling about, reading or meandering around the internet, downloading music for the next stretch and catching up with news from home. My fingernail caught across my screen mid-scroll, and I sighed, deciding that with its patchwork of cracks, my phone screen protector had finally reached the end of its life. I had a spare from the two-pack that I'd picked up in Maine and had been saving it until this one got really tired. I decided that after dropping the phone multiple times up and down mountains, it was time to let it go and change up. As I began to peel off the cracked and shattered protector, I could see Buckshot looking over. "That thing still holding together?" he asked, watching it come off my screen in one piece. "Yeah, but it's pretty trashed, though." I looked at it in my hand. "It might last another couple of weeks, maybe. All the spider web parts held together by the top coating." "I'll take it," he said. "Sure," I replied. "Pass me over your phone, and I'll see if it's the right size for your screen with my new sealed one before you slap it on. The sticky is already pretty rubbish." He stood up and padded over, pulling his phone from his pocket. I took it from him and held up my new protector over it. "Yes, perfect. A little wrong for the side edges, but it'll do for a while." I flipped his phone over to take it out of the case to see if the size looked any better without it. Oh, wait, a phone case. I hadn't seen this before. I vaguely knew his phone had a case, as I'd seen it when it was clipped to his pack for hiking, but I didn't remember it ever being in a case sitting around in motel rooms. I'd never really seen it up close, and as I looked down at the back of it, flipped over in my hand, I realised why. It was a girl. Buckshot and a girl. Standing together at an overlook, arms around each other, wearing hiking gear and smiling. Together. My skin goose-fleshed and went cold. He hadn't yet clocked it, what he'd done. He'd clearly been hiding the case when we were together and clipping it back on for hiking. I looked up at him. "What's this?" I asked. "What?" He wasn't paying attention. My phone? Do you want me to put the protector on? Here, let me..." And he looked back down at my hands properly and at the back of the phone case turned up towards us, at two sets of women's eyes looking at him. Only one of the women could currently speak, though, so I did the asking for us both. "What the heck?" I asked. "Who is this?" I said, gesturing at the case. He froze, like the deer in the woods we frequented. "What do you mean?" He studiously looked around the case, at me, at the floor, at anything except my hands. A naughty dog caught out next to a destroyed garbage bag in the kitchen. "What do you mean, what do I mean? Who is this girl, Buckshot?" He frowned, rallied, then a torrent rushed out. She's my friend. I don't know why she sent me that case." My heart was pounding in my mouth, and I couldn't speak. I just raised my eyebrows above my welling eyes. He shrugged maniacally. "I don't know why. She just posted it over. We hiked sometime in the past. It's dumb, so dumb she sent it. She's just a friend. I don't know." I just stared at him. "Jesus, Gale," he said, exasperated with me, annoyed, caught, exposed. He bowed his head, wiped his face with both hands like splashing it from a stream. Silence. We were racing towards the crossroads where everything was about to change, and I wanted to stay frozen in this moment before. I didn't want to know this, what was coming.
"Okay, fine. I have a fucking girlfriend."
He looked at me furiously. I couldn't speak. I managed a "but," and then was quiet. We were both quiet. Him kneeling up, me kneeling low, facing each other. The crossroad moment reached. I had vaguely known he'd had a girlfriend in the past. In Maine, I'd been told by Dozer that she lived overseas, that they hadn't seen each other in a long time, and that he'd finished with her. Nothing to do with me, so I hadn't raised it. But no, that wasn't right. I had raised it on our first night together in bed in the Rangeley Motel. I had asked whether he was seeing anyone, and he had replied no and was offended by the question. After that, I had just leaned into it. To him, fell forwards into it all, talked myself out of the differences, the difficulties, the disappearing, which I now guessed was for phone calls to her on mountaintops where there was a good signal. The inexplicable sullen moods and distance when he caught up to me in the late mornings after he'd probably made contact with her and then felt a surge of guilt about me. But I had been so stupid, and now I was deeply in it. I had opened my heart to this man and let myself rely on him, trusted his words and felt safe with him. He was my partner, my trail family, my everything right now. He had begun talking, but I wasn't really listening. I mentally shook myself, tuned out of my own mind and into his words. I feel bad. I keep feeling bad. I didn't mean to do this, but I couldn't seem to stay away from you. I tried. I tried to leave, but I couldn't. Where is she, Buckshot? In Europe. Right. Well, does she know about me? Like, is she okay with it? Do you guys have an open relationship? I looked down at the smiling girl on the phone case. She would not be okay with it. No, she doesn't know. And no, she wouldn't be okay. Look, angry now. Look, Gail, I don't want to talk about it, about her. I thought about breaking up with her, but I'm not going to. It's complicated. And with that, he turned away. I moved myself outside onto the dusky terrace, started slapping stinging DEET onto my legs and arms, enjoying the pain of the noxious liquid seeping into wounds, hurting me. What a stupid, stupid woman I was. So embarrassed, so hurt. The humiliation surged through me. I had thought we had something special. Ugh, you fool. I sat, stared into the woods, and let my analytical, overthinking brain spin uselessly through the Rubik's Cube of ways this could still be okay, and how I could still maintain any combination of ethical integrity, this trail family unit, our closeness, my safety, and my heart. Why wasn't I angry? I should be angry. I wasn't. I was more worried about losing my partner out here. How could he really have a girlfriend? We'd been with each other since day 5 on the trail. Surely I'd have known if it were true. But there was a photo. He had admitted it. Well, maybe on trail it didn't matter. It was a different world, a different reality. We could still keep it how it was, at least the friendship element, until he had to go and join his family in a few weeks for a vacation. That's what would have to happen. I needed that to happen. Oh, but my heart hurts so much. I stared out into the dark garden and let the tears come, knowing that whatever came next, something had been irrevocably broken. He came outside after some time had passed. I'd seen him looking, felt him coming closer, then leaving again. He was unsettled. He had nothing he could say to make it better. He was with her. But he had also done what he'd done. He cared about me. I think this much I knew. It's up to you what we do, he said, standing behind me in the dark. I'll do it whatever way you want, but at some point I have to go. You know that. I've always known that. I don't want to go. If it means anything, I really like you. I didn't turn. Just spoke my need. I don't want to be without you right now. He was quiet as he absorbed this. My lack of anger, the chance to have his cake and eat it too, if he could swallow the guilt with it. My choice to sacrifice some ethical code to stay safe. I was grateful that this silent wrangling of trade-offs was happening in the darkness. Good. I'm glad, he said eventually. I'm not a bad person, Gail. And with that, we went to our beds. The next day we hiked into the Kinsmans, on the surface like nothing had happened. I was willing the knowledge I had to disappear, but I couldn't help but run our whole time together through a different lens, looking for things I'd missed, either honestly or being dishonestly blind with myself to live out the day-to-day that I was in. Thankfully, the events of the hike that day were to overshadow our emotional circumstances. Buckshot's sandal breaking on a steep descent and an extreme red heat alert took me out of dwelling in my head and to problem-solving in the moment, which meant a double back to the Days Inn Hotel in Lincoln for our third night in the town and a Chinese feast and a beer to chase away any blues. I slept deeply, desperate to put Lincoln and all that had been revealed there far behind me. Chapter 10. I Can't See the Wood for the Trees. We'd finally left Lincoln for good, and the first mountain out, Moosalocki, was the biggest and baddest we'd have to hike for a while. Buckshot pulled ahead quickly, and I fell further back, happy but tired and toting a full pack with a quart of whiskey tucked inside my front pouch for the summit. It took me a while to ascend, and I chatted to others coming down. I was quite happy with this, our cadence. He was ahead, I fell behind. I didn't have breaks in the whole day, but he did, and in those moments I'd catch up with him, always waiting for me by a stream or river, snacking or smoking. It was the norm, and I liked it. Just as I cleared the forest cover and hiked up some boulders over beyond the tree line, I passed a younger couple and asked if they'd seen Buckshot. My usual description of him being a huge man with a big beard. The usual reply, yes, yes, about 20 or 30 minutes ahead. Fantastic, he'd be at the summit waiting for me. He wasn't at the summit. All that was at the summit were bitter winds cutting through my clothes and a series of confusing paths and signs. I waited a little, muddled, and looked a little way down the paths. I then started out, only to double back when I looked behind at a noise and noticed a sign pointing back the way I'd come, which wasn't a white blaze. I'd picked the wrong way down. How the hell did I manage that? Back I went, smiling ruefully at my near miss, and headed down the other side. It was a hectic descent, clambering down a cascade of huge rocks which had sat there for eons. Each step down more than 1.5 times deeper than my usual gait, each foot placement more likely to be the sharp edge of a boulder tipped sideways than a flat plane. My trusty pole took the burden that my wobbly legs were struggling with. I was cross with myself, really. I loved a plan, to know where I was going and where I was going to sleep, to aim for the end of the day and know when relaxation was in sight. Buckshot didn't want to make plans. He wanted to hike until dark, or beyond, see how far he could push it each day and then lie in the dirt wherever that was. He seemed joyfully invincible, and I wished I could be the same, so I tried to embrace this feeling of never knowing where he would be or where I could stop for the day. I knew the alternative was being totally alone, because I'd let other chances at trail families slip by as I focused on the excitement and adventure that our bizarre on-off connection could provide. But I knew it was losing its lustre, and that I'd gambled too much and was now at risk of throwing good money after bad on my dedication to this union. Damn it, I hated facing my cowardice, but soon I figured I'd have to stop, regroup, let him go and set back off at my own pace and make my own plans. Surely that was why I had taken this on in the first place. Mastery of my fear, a challenge to my body and a goodbye to the physical limit that had been imposed on me by my pain. For some reason, I have always felt deeply unsettled out in the deep woods when the early evening arrives. A gentle warning. When the fading light sends stretching shadows and the atmosphere shifts from being expansive to claustrophobic. I feel less welcome and have to press down hard on my rising panic. I had been canny at avoiding this uneasy feeling by ensuring I had someone who knew where I was or that I was coming and they expected me to arrive, and I'd made peace with the fact that this made me a wimp. I didn't care, because right now I had found someone who had helped build my confidence, and I knew I wasn't ready to take the leap alone yet. But on this day, as afternoon came, I hadn't seen him for many hours. I knew he must be just ahead, so I sped up and began flying down the mountain at an increasing pace, looking around every bend and anticipating every spring, thinking he would be waiting for me. He wasn't. I couldn't conceive that he'd just left me. Even though we both knew that his departure was inevitable soon, I thought that we were closely enough joined that he would warn me. Or so I hoped. I couldn't understand where he was. It wasn't until I dropped out of the bottom of the mountain proper and crossed a few dusty roads that I began to feel properly worried. We hadn't crossed many roads on trail at this point, and roads always felt strangely like someone shining a torch in my eyes. It was also where everyone sagely advises you not to be if you're a woman alone, because it's where you are most likely to encounter anyone with ill intentions, within a few miles of trailheads. I blundered across the roads and through the trail to the next shelter, which was about 400 feet in. The dark was swallowing the path, and I was convinced Buckshot would be there, even if only to tell me he was heading on and this was it, the moment he was leaving. He wasn't. It was a forest, twilight-filled, empty space, surrounded by pines, containing exactly no one. It was here that I tipped over into the place that I think I'd always feared most. The place that had held me back from camping alone, from certain risks that engendered rising panic I always felt and put so many coping mechanisms in place to avoid bubbling over. Even mechanisms that weren't healthy and caused me to share a bed with men that weren't good for me, but that were less risky than letting the terror in. But now the terror had its foot in the door, and I had nothing in my arsenal to stop it. No taxi to call. No hotel room to book into, no girlfriends to go and see, no excuses to make to get into my car, and no amount of good upbringing, career, money in the bank or achievements could protect me from how I was feeling. The walls were torn down and the fears were mixing. No antidote. I started to sob. Terror sprang from nowhere and everywhere. I was seeing faces and shapes in the woods that